Okay, well, I'm John Beck, and I co-director of Daily Work at Daily Lives, and we're happy today. In a minute, I'll introduce Heather, and I'm so happy that she's back because of the fact that her original brown bag, when she didn't have a voice, was one of the most interesting single presentations in 20 years of this series, as far as I was concerned. It made me look at knitting in a whole new way. And so we're very happy that she's back, but have to do a couple of announcements or it wouldn't be me. First of all, I commend to all of you to come downstairs. All of our public programming is over in relation to the exhibit, but our exhibit, Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters, Ore Boats, Workers, and Great Lakes Shipping, will be open until January 24th. So I do ask you to go down to the ground floor gallery and check it out. It's really worth seeing. And if you need a flyer to, as your reminder, 2 weeks from, you know, I even spelled Thursday wrong. Oh, my God. So in this really bad typographical error flyer, on Thursday, December 3rd, we'll have another, for the most part, craft-based presentation when Tom Pearson's going to be here. Tom was a skilled tradesman at General Motors, and he did what's called metal spinning. And metal spinning, you spin a piece of metal at such a rate and it flattens out. And he now uses that skill that he developed as a skilled tradesman at General Motors to make craft items, things like candle holders, other kinds of things. But he's going to look at the origin of the craft as well as current use. So ignore my typographical error. And as many of the constant attendees know, I go on sabbatical in January. But I'll be coming back and forth. But because of being on sabbatical in January, we're only doing one brown bag a month in the spring. So all four of them are in large type on this. And so I'll send that around. So you will see my smiling face, but just not as often. And last but not least, I will send around the sign-in sheet. There are sign-in sheets at various points in the room, but I'll send one around just for yucks. And thank you for signing in. We love to know who's here. So today, it is absolutely my immense pleasure to reintroduce Heather Prishtash to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. Heather and I were just talking about how it was that I originally found her, and it was because of a conference program from a radicalism conference that was run here at MSU, right? And like I said, I began to understand things about knitting that I never thought possible, this whole area of protest knitting and protest craft. So she came and really showed us some amazing things about protest knitting. Today, she's talking about a handmade response to sweatshops, craftivism, protest, and critique of consumer culture. She's currently a tenured professor at Western Wyoming Community College and far away from home, because she was raised in Ohio, did her PhD at Bowling Green. And please help me welcome Heather Prishtash back to our Daily Work at Daily Lives.
Thank you so much, John. And thank you for inviting me back. I really enjoyed it the first time, even without a voice, and that says something. So, as John said, I am currently out in Wyoming at Western Wyoming Community College, but my interest in this goes back to working at Bowling Green State University. So there are some people who do this kind of work, but not quite enough of them. I do want to acknowledge one person who I actually did work with during my graduate years, and I pull from in here, Sue Carter Wood. And I'll be referring to her work on WCTU quilts here in a minute. Anyway, before I move to the specific topic of sweatshops and sweatshop-related craft, let me give you a little bit of background. I identify as a feminist, a knitter, rhetorician, and a scholar. And in all of those, I'm passionately interested in women's craft traditions, particularly in the realm of textiles. Obviously, there are male crafters as well, but at this point, it's a very highly gendered practice, particularly when we get into needlecraft. But when I share this curiosity with others, they're sometimes confused as to why anybody, much less an avowed feminist, would spend time studying needlework and other craft media, especially in the modern era. And I've had people say, well, that was really important when that was the only way they could communicate, but why do we need it now? I mean, women can run for president and give speeches. Why is this still important? Well, I disagree. Craft is still a feminist issue for a variety of reasons. However, one of its most urgent is rhetorical usage throughout history, as well as the really specific, unique opportunities it affords today. These meaning-making opportunities, I'll show you, present unique advantages in lots of situations, such as protest. And also, since we're dealing with the kind of rhetoric here that it's about the production of a material artifact, it's especially useful in the critique of any other project that creates material artifacts, such as sweatshop labor. Now, my focus on needlework of varying kinds, although I do occasionally look at other craft, means that I look at this practice as what I term rhetorical needlework. Now, that kind of needlework covers knitting, quilting, sashiko, embroidery, all sorts of practices. Now, I initially defined this as needlework which can be read as meaning-making, either through its process, its product, or both. Now, in order to make that definition more complete, I fleshed this out with criteria from Robert Herrick, his distinguishing features of rhetorical discourse. And I'm going to take my earrings off in case the jingling is messing with the sound recording, because it's actually messing with me. So rhetorical discourse, as categorized by Herrick, is planned, is adapted to an audience, shaped by human motives, responsive to a situation, persuasion-seeking, and concerned with contingent issues. Now, I won't go into these in great depth, but I think a lot of these can very easily be seen in a lot of needlework, even if you don't call it specifically rhetorical. But I would say that most of them can be found, if not all, in these pieces that I'm talking about that are specifically engaging with communication and rhetoric. So now that we have a solid footing on what I mean by rhetorical needlework, I want to move into craftivism. And it's one of the most fertile categories of rhetorical needlework, especially right now. And it's the one that I'll largely focus on here today. Now, the term was predominantly coined by Betsy Greer, who's a knitter. And in her book, Craftivism, The Art of Art and Activism, or sorry, The Art of Craft and Activism, which I highly recommend, by the way, she discusses the juxtaposition of an encounter she had with political puppetry while doing her own personal knitting that spurred her on to thinking about craft as a political act. And I quote, "I had always thought that activism had to be loud and in your face. Maybe the quietness of the puppets resonated with the quietness of the knitting, but it made me think about quiet activism and how craft could be a part of it. Later in a research proposal, I explained that the creation of things by hand leads us to a better understanding of democracy because it reminds us that we have power. I felt that artists needed a term for crafting that was motivated by social or political activism, and craftivism fit the bill." Now, many had used craft in this manner before Greer's adoption of the term, but this clarified concept struck a chord for many, especially but not exclusively needleworkers. A great deal of needlework has since been done with activist intent, some of it very deliberately categorized as craftivist, but all of it arguably in that same spirit that Greer gives voice to. Now, some of that activist work has taken the form of utilitarian pieces done for donation or fundraising, but a lot of it has taken place in the form of public art on large or small scale. It's been work meant to help convey meaning, work that, in Greer's words, is meant to foment dialogue while helping to breathe life into artistic practices that some people may think are obsolete by showing their relevancy and poignancy. In short, this is meaning-rich work that's very rhetorically significant. And what I have here is one of those pieces that's definitely informed by Greer, the Craftifesto. It's a statement of principles in line with these craftivist beliefs. And if you can't see some of the smaller handwritten bits in the back, it states that craft is powerful, personal, political, and possible for everyone. Everybody can create something. I can't agree more, and I think that's a powerful statement in and of itself. Now, the tradition of rhetorical needlework arguably stretches back to Bayeux Tapestry, which is a massive embroidered piece, oddly enough, with it being called a tapestry, of Norman propaganda and beyond. But I want to look at a few more recent works as general establishing examples before moving to sweatshop focus work. Now, these come from the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or WCTU, as I mentioned before. It was founded in the late 19th century by Frances Willard, and this group pushed for both temperance and full prohibition, basing their stance on alcohol on both women's status as protectors of the home and on Christian morals. Now, this group was really rhetorically savvy, as Carol Mattingly, among other scholars, have pointed out. Mattingly writes, "Many late 19th century women, instead of seeking rhetorical skills at institutions of higher learning, sought and received such instruction within the reform movements, women teaching women. Now, the largest of these organizations and the most effective in teaching women rhetorical skills was the WCTU, especially successful because new members learned public presentation from skillful teachers who understood women's particular needs. Now, the particular needs spoken of here are many because the concept of a woman speaking in public at that time was still viewed with no little amount of skepticism. However, that organization fought quietly for a woman's right to speak using the aforementioned training, careful deportment, a reliance on scripture, and interestingly, needlecraft. This is one of their most discussed strategies, needlework, particularly used in their speaking halls. Sue Carter asserts that as it was fraught with difficulty for women to take public roles as speakers and activists at this point in time, displays of craft on the stages from which the women of the WCTU were to speak marked the stages as women's space visually, much as a display of craft could develop a power balance in the home. This visual rhetoric helped the speakers to retain their proper feminine ethos, the audience's ability to see them as proper women, while engaged in a very unladylike occupation of public speaking. Also, the display art served to give constrained women an outlet through which they could express their own reform beliefs, their belief in the WCTU. In this way, needlework served to empower a group of women, helping give them the ability to speak both visually and verbally, and serving both as statement and permission to make a statement. So in these examples, you see the WCTU colors of white and blue. Now, some of these quilts, like the one on the right, very obvious in their intent. It's got WCTU right on it. Not going to miss it. It's got signatures, I believe, from people who are part of the group. It's very, very obvious. However, that wasn't always the case. In fact, famously, one of the things that some women did, particularly if they were with spouses who didn't support the WCTU, maybe were drinkers themselves, they could do WCTU quilts that were coded as a message that might not be understood by an unsupportive spouse and still take part in an organization they believed in strongly. Part of this is just by using the white and blue colors. Part of this also, if you see this pattern on the left, that's a drunkard's path. And that was used, and this is less documented and argued a bit, but there's a lot of documentation to support it, that was used by a lot of WCTU quilts as a symbol of the drunkard's wandering path. So in and of itself, it's rhetorical. Now, another example that is technically historical because it began in the 80s, but still ongoing is the AIDS Memorial Quilt. Now, I understand that part of the quilt will soon be on display here, so I won't spend too much time talking about it. I'm figuring you're going to do that in the near future. But I will mention that by any measure, this is one of the biggest examples of rhetorical needlework. It was started by a single activist, Cleve Jones, in 1985. In 2012, The Atlantic covered the quilt's most recent display in its entirety at the National Mall. However, they note, in its entirety does not mean all at once. The quilt is too big for the mall to hold. Instead, droves of volunteers were used to cycle the sections on and off the lawns. With nearly 50,000 separate panels, It weighs more than 53 tons and would require 1.3 million square feet to be displayed all at once. So this huge segment of the mall, it's just a fraction. And again, if you look at pieces closely, it's very clearly rhetorical. It's very clearly honoring somebody, speaking of their lives, speaking against this disease. Now, a more recent example of rhetorical needlework, and this is from 2014, is a project called Wool Against Weapons. Now, this was based in the UK, and it was a project that intended to call attention to and criticize moves to replace the Trident nuclear weapons program. Now, in order to do so, crafters in the UK rallied people from around the world. They got submissions from all over the place. And they decided to make a scarf that would stretch between two of the atomic weapons establishments that would supply Trident warheads if the program began again. Now, one of these is in Aldermaston, and one of these is in Bergfield. Now, of course, you guys know where those are, right? I did too, so. No, they're 7 miles apart. So this stretched 7 miles of knitting. Police assistance was necessary to do this, to close roads and control traffic enough to actually join the pieces together and display them on the day when they finally put them all together. I will note that unfortunately here in the US, something similar happened and the people with the scarf were arrested. So call that what you will. Now, to highlight the immensity of the project, I have a video queued up that will take you on a tour of its 7 mile length that was supposed to be embedded, and PowerPoint is just disagreeing with me fervently, so I have my lovely assistant helping.
Yeah, it's gone fantastic here. It's been brilliant. Can't believe how organised everyone is. And after driving the route first thing this morning, it's now amazing that the same route is just 7 miles of wool. I never thought it would happen. So thank you to everyone who's contributed your bits of knit.
So, as I understand it, if one person had knitted constantly for 24 hours a day, it would have taken them 27 years to knit this much scarf.
That's fantastic.
To let you know that we are complete.
Love the ask me what I am knitting button that many of them were wearing in order to increase the popularity of, awareness of this project. Basically, that last piece, Wool Against Weapons, it's unmissable. There's no way you could miss that. And as far as I understand it, every single piece of it along the way was hand-knitted. There was no machine knitting involved. Think about the amount of work that that shows. And you have people who are standing there holding it, but at the same time, they're holding this massive textile that symbolically joins them to people who cannot be present to stand there with them, which is really powerful. So, whatever effect and impact these events had, and I think there's a lot of it, I think there's even more potential in a lot of ways for rhetorical needlework and craftivism to be used in anti-sweatshop actions. Now, there are a few reasons for this. First, debates around labor practices are not new. We've been having them for a long time. So, if you've been having the debate for a long time and you haven't been heard, what about making the statement in another way? Another point of attack. So, it has an ability to speak to new people that messages have not reached before. Second, there's the sheer ability of the act of making itself to deepen crafters' commitment to a cause. Now, I don't know how many people in here craft, so forgive me if I'm saying something you already know. But crafting is wonderful. It's joyous. It's empowering. And by hour 20 or 30 or 300 on a project, it kind of sucks. You get to the point where it's painfully annoying, where you have to rip something out, where you have to redo it, where it's physically painful. So, if you go through both the high and the low of that, working on something for others, it can mean something. It can allow you to think about an experience that someone else is having. It can make you empathize in a whole new way. If you're enjoying your work, it can lead you to think about people who are doing creation that aren't enjoying it. If you're having a rough time with a project, it can simultaneously lead you to think about how much more difficult someone else's struggles might be. And the same kinds of struggles, your hands hurt, your back hurts, you mess something up and you have to rip it out. Those are going to be the same between a handcrafter here and somebody who's working in a sweatshop situation. Now finally, and most powerfully, crafted work in response to sweatshop labor can function to humanize the practice and bring home the problem for an uninformed viewer. It's really easy for many people to forget that things we buy, they come from somewhere. Somebody made them. They don't magically appear. Just because it comes from a factory doesn't mean a human's not involved. So, we still have a problem that people are not perceiving that maker. But if they're confronted with something handmade or with people making things, if they see the work that one person is putting into a scarf and they can recognize my work as a knitter, can't that lead them to think about other people making things? If I'm talking about how long something took me to make, how much effort, it allows them to see the similarities if they see someone like them making something to someone who is also like them who they may never come into contact with at all. All right, so it's not my intent to create a hard and fast typology of anti-sweatshop rhetorical needlework, but I have seen a few specific varieties of it in my research. I find it useful to look at them separately. The first is large-scale public work, much like Wool Against Weapons. Often involves separate contributions from different people that are grouped and stitched together. Often, once those pieces have been put together, it leads to they're either displayed in a museum or they're taken apart to be used as some sort of charitable work or to be auctioned off. For instance, in Wool Against Weapons, that scarf was broken down into blankets that were donated to shelters. Now, this type of work is often very attention-getting because of its size and display. That's great because it's hard to miss, but it can also be a negative thing, depending on your viewer. It can feel too in your face. It can feel too confrontational. and less dialogic than other kinds of rhetorical needlework. So one of the best examples of this type is the Nike blanket petition. Now, this project was started by Kat Mazza, who is pictured in the upper right. And a key building block of her doing this was her creation of software called KnitPro, that you can take any image, put it into, and it's pixelated, and it's broken up along the lines of whatever you tell it to do for a certain kind of crafting. So her original use for this activity, she was something she called logo knitting. That was a reappropriation of corporate logos that encourages thought about labor practices and consumer culture. So taking the Barbie logo and knitting it into something. Taking other logos and putting them in weird places that make people think. She's done some really cool stuff with this. But this software enabled her to create one of her biggest logo works of all. Now, this is a massive work. It's about 5 feet by 12 feet in size. And the Nike logo here has been cut into 4x4 squares. It's depicted in one of its most familiar color combos, orange on background with white. But each square is a signature knitted by separate contributors for the project. Now, and then it's bordered, as you can see, by logo by squares of the same size or of differing sizes. And they're all different fabric has been produced, different colors, stripes, different textures, different gauge. So we go from very uniform in the center out to wild diversity. Now, why is this effective? Well, one way the power is codified, particularly in our age of multinational corporations and visual rhetoric, is through the use of logos. We understand what a logo means, and it's identifying somebody's power as a corporate entity. Part of the power that Nike has is their logo. You throw that swoosh on anything, and they're claiming it. It's intended for them and them only. Private citizens are often constrained by the powers of corporations, but using their logos, taking them from and reappropriating them, is rebellious in a really specifically postmodern way. Now, not only did she steal, reappropriate the logo, but she also fractured it. It would have been fairly easy for Mazza to knit this either in one piece on a knitting machine or in stripes where it wouldn't be as clearly broken up, but she chooses to break the logo apart into a number of pieces. She wanted to bring group participation to the project. She could still have done it another way. Here, she's chosen to fragment the logo, which can be read as fragmenting or unmaking corporate power. So the final way that the power of the logo is subverted is through the application of that multicolored border. So she was very tight on the controls of the piece itself. You had to use a specific color, a specific yarn. But that border, get crazy, do whatever you want. Because it winds up making a clear statement of the individuality of everybody creating that piece, that you see the different people. There's almost an encapsulation happening, a message to Nike that we, the knitters, are bigger than you. Now, another aspect that needs to be considered is its status as a handmade material object. It's, after all, being used to protest labor conditions. So, as it was noted in the catalog of the Radical Lace and Subversive Knitting exhibition in the UK, where this did appear, the handmade petition emphasized the ways in which mass-produced garments are made and underscored the amount of work that goes into making them. So, here, textile-based work allows for a kind of protest that would never be possible otherwise. Now, also, the website for this piece is quite interesting, and I recommend that you check it out. It is, they have this picture of the blanket, and then they have a list of states and countries. And you can click on any one of them and see all the squares. So all the squares from Michigan will pop up and you can see them. Or you can mouse over it and see who did which square. And it's really interesting. And that keeps highlighting the number of people that participated in the project. Now, Mazza's original goal with this was to hand it to the CEO as a protest. That's never quite happened. but she has used it to take around and display and inform people, which I think is also very valid. Now, that said, not every project needs to be massive and multinational to be interesting. There are also some smaller projects. They might be easier to overlook based on sheer size. After all, there's no way you're missing that blanket in a room. But they invite rather than demand attention. Multiple people can participate in them, but it's not something that you have to have multiple people in order to make it work. Also, since they're not as massive, they can be focused on a very specific message, as opposed to one really clear thing that the entire work is communicating. So it can have more nuance. It can be a more nuanced invitation to think about something, rather than a very in-your-face stance on it. So a great example of this is the mini banners created by the Craftivist Collective. Now, the example I'm showing here was put up during London Fashion Week in 2014. In case you can't read the text clearly, it says, "Lowest paid models at London Fashion Week paid £125 an hour. Majority of garment workers in Vietnam paid £25 a month." Now, it's a close-up of the banner. This is not that much bigger than, say, a large-ish postcard. It's a small piece, and if you want to engage it, you have to make the decision to stop and read it. And then think about it. It's handmade, and it's not taking an accusatory tone. Now, this one does get a little more confrontational on the right. It reads, "There is no point to a globalization that reduces the price of the child's shoes but costs the father his job." Still, the message and the mask, it's more confrontational but encourages viewers to think through things. Also, notice that the level of craft here is not complex. This is easy stuff to do. Maybe we've done it ourselves, even as children. This looks relatable. And also, that draws from the kit on the right that the Craftivist Collective sells online to support their efforts and also simultaneously to invite people to join in their work. The third type of work I've seen is a personal project. Now, I can't say as much about these because they're so different. There are so many different takes on it. But it's interesting that they're a tool for education through lived experience. People who observe them might be encouraged to join in, but they're also welcome to just hang back and watch. These do happen on a small level, so they're easy to lose track of, but online culture and social media has really broadened the reach of these, making some of them almost cult hits. Now, these are more difficult to provide concrete examples of, but I'm going to throw out two here. The first on the left is a pledge that has to do with both consumption and creation. Now, if you can't see the fine print, it's a website banner asking people to take a pledge that at least half of the holiday gifts that they will give are handmade, either by themselves or by someone else. Now, this is simultaneously asking people to vote against unjust labor practices with their money and asking people to engage in making themselves. So it's a two-pronged attack, and this is really from one website. The second group of photos is a series of pictures from the original Uniform Project. Now, this started in May of 2009, and the woman who started, Sheena Mathakin, wore one dress every day for a year, only adding accessories to change her look. It's the same dress in every piece. But the accessories could only be vintage, recycled, donated by someone else, or handmade. So, this is multifaceted. It's bringing together awareness of global labor practices, it's bringing together environmental issues, and it's bringing together simple creativity. Now, there have been a lot of other projects that have occurred kind of along these same lines. And it can be powerful because of the number of areas they bring together. Somebody might just start paying attention to the project because, oh, hey, that's a cool fashion idea. I really like what she's doing with that scarf. That's neat. And at the end, they have been informed about sweatshops. They have been informed about the ecological costs of different textile practices. They're thinking in a whole new way. That's also powerful. So, there are four major things I want you to take away from this. Now, for the academically inclined among us, there is so much to research in this field of rhetorical needlework, of varying kinds, of rhetorical craft of varying kinds. There is so much to do here, and I encourage anybody who finds it even vaguely interesting, join in. Now, for those who aren't necessarily as academically inclined, there's still a lot of help needed by those of us who have a little more information about these projects and who are thinking about them in an informed way as you are now. Sometimes the media will cover them as a curiosity. More voices jumping in and getting the conversation going about why they're significant is really helpful. And there are several projects out there, you know, that paying attention to and helping in that way would really be a good idea. There's opportunities for protest at whatever volume and whatever level of involvement you're interested in. If you want to get something fabulous going and be the next Kat Mazza with like a 20-foot blanket, go ahead with your bad self. Send me an invite, I'll knit you a square. That's great. If you look at this and you're like, wow, that's really important. Maybe I could do one of those little signs and put it up outside Walmart. You can knock that out in an hour or two. There's all sorts of opportunities for really thoughtful and thought-provoking involvement. Now, also, opportunities for all of you right now, whether or not you're a crafter right now, thinking about these things, could you commit for the upcoming holiday gifting season to buying more handmade gifts? Could you commit, even if you don't think you're a crafter right now, to making something yourself, even if it sucks? A handmade gift is a special thing, and it does make a statement about these issues, as well as many more, in your relationship with the other person. So, is that something you could do right now? Give it some thought. It's a good way to bring some activism and some meaning into this season that keeps you thinking about these important issues. So, what questions do you guys have for me?
Well, first of all, before we do anything else, let us give Heather a round of applause for that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
So, the floor is open for comments, questions. Anybody want to jump? Dorothy.
Well, I think it's a fascinating topic, and a lot to think about in a short period of time, but I'm thinking of a football player, and I think his name was Roger,
yeah.
Who sat on the sideline and hit while the football won, mm-hmm. on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And another famous one, because that was at least 20 years ago, but mm-hmm.
Madame Lafarge.
Mm-hmm.
Madame Lafarge.
Yeah, Lafarge. She had knit their names into something, and as we went down, she mm-hmm. unraveled sort of a psychology.
Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of people who've been inspired by Madame Lafarge. There's actually a series of books called What Would Madame Lafarge Knit? That are literature-based knitting patterns. In one case, they riffed it with Shakespeare, so what would Shakespeare knit? Or, now, with Rosie Grier, I think I've heard about him doing that, and I think it's fascinating, and there's a lot to study around craft, especially needlecraft and masculinity, because we have so many messages around it. Even though technically, yes, anybody can pick up needles and start knitting, how many men kind of like, no. Now, it's funny because I have taught men to knit, including on one memorable occasion, an actual rocket scientist. So I can say you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do it. In fact, he was a bit crap, but he was very willing to learn. My line on it kind of goes back to my father. My father is 6'4", big guy, muy macho, retired trucker. Who knows how to knit? So I'll often refer to him and be like, okay, if he isn't, you know, taken down by this, if this isn't something he's too macho to do, you're fine. But there's a lot of dialogue to be had around the issue of male knitters. There's also a very famous one, Franklin Habit, who talks on his blog about this experience he had on the subway. And he's knitting incredibly complicated color work, and he's got four colors going at once, and it's intricate. And this woman comes up and says, oh, are you learning how to knit? Largely because he's male. And I love him because he looked at her and just kind of smiled and said, "No, I learned how to knit in prison." And she walked away, oddly enough, and that was the end of the conversation. But apparently he did decide to sell "I learned to knit in prison" t-shirts because of it.
Let me ask a question, Heather, and other people might be interested in the same kind of notion. This is part of the slow movement in its own way, too.
Absolutely.
Right? So that as we find things, it's revaluing time. Because to a great degree, folks are giving up an unbelievable amount of time to do the stuff that they're doing. And I'm reminded, there's a wonderful quote from Robert Merton. About the idea that on a Coleman lamp there was, you know, to stretch the day and to make the day longer or whatever through Coleman light. And he was reacting to the notion of, and I think it even went on to say, for plenty of more time of fun or whatever. You know, so there was this whole notion of stretching our time. This is really about compacting our time, isn't it? I mean, it's important. This is something that someone put love into. This is something that someone put rage into. This is something that someone put time into, right, by comparison, right?
Yeah, well, there's definitely two competing impulses there, because you can look at, on any bookshelf, any bookstore that carries crafting books, and there's a big quick knit projects, things to do in 2 hours. You can still show people you love them and get everything else done. And then there's like traditional Fair Isle with Alice Starmore that's 27 colors, you know, stitches the size of a flea, and you may finish it before you die if you just keep going and you're like 12. So it's interesting because these are two impulses that craft itself struggles with. What I also find interesting, though, is how much rhetorical craft illuminates those impulses and illuminates the time it spends. For instance, and this is actually kind of Defarge-inspired as well, one artist set up in a window in a shop, I believe, and she decided to knit a newspaper. And every day, she would just keep knitting about new events and knit the words in about the top news stories and just keep going. She was like human ticker tape. It was amazing. And you could look at it and you see this record of time unfolding as she goes. At the same time, and I think I mentioned them last time I was here, there's the Gulf War mittens that were a pattern that you would start and put the number of dead when you first started on one mitten, then keep going. Then as you move to the next one, number of dead at that time. And in and of themselves, they function as a record of that time. So it's one of the really interesting things about any kind of craft is the way it records the time as you do it. And rhetorically, people really play with that.
Okay, other comments or questions?
Yes, absolutely. I've actually advised at my institution a knitting club. There are some college students who are rabidly interested in the way that only a college student can be rabidly interested in crafts of various kinds. There's definitely a movement among younger people. And actually, if you look at the Craft Yarn Guild or some of the big associations having to do with knitting, a lot of studies in that art show that the number of new knitters and knitters who are self-identified knitters who are in their late teens to late 20s has spiked hugely in the last 15 years. So there's definitely some of that. Now, I can't promise that they're not also getting drunk or using drugs or possibly knitting a bong cozy, but, you know, there is that definite interest for sure.
Other question? I mean, and one thing I'm struck by is that I work in South Africa every year. Mm-hmm. And so there it's bead culture and also phone wire
mm-hmm. Oh,
baskets and other things. Mm-hmm. So to what degree is knitting, I mean, have we seen the same thing in terms of beadwork, for example, in the United States or within the UK? Or is there something special about needlework that simply just brings it on?
Now, there's a lot of work that brings the two together, both beadwork and knitting. And there's a lot of what you're talking about that is really textile creation, like with the phone wires, mm-hmm. things that are woven. That is creating a textile. So they actually have a lot in common. There has been some beadwork and some popularity with beadwork in the US. I don't think it's as large. Mm-hmm. I think, as I understand it, and this is me just taking a blind shot as someone who knows something about crafts, I think some of it is that there's a stronger beading tradition there than there necessarily is here among the average person. Because here, the concept of you're making something beaded, well, that's fancy stuff. That's a really spiffy shawl that you only wear on special occasions. That's a really fancy bracelet. As opposed to, this is traditionally a part of everyday life. I think we see what we interact with most. And I do think, you know, obviously I'm biased to the yarn crafts, I admit that. I think with some of those, there is a real appeal to the fact that you can pick it up, put it down very easily. You can start it very cheaply. A lot of other crafts, you have to have more of a setup. You have to have more to draw from, and you have more of an investment. And I think that's also part of it here in the US with beading. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The bells are really something today. Other comments or questions that folks have? Let me ask about painted fabric, mm-hmm. just because that's another area too. Uh-huh. Has there been a good amount of, like, including painting on silk or painting on fabric as part of the protest movements or craftivism?
There's definitely been some of that. There's definitely been some of that, particularly with art quilting, that you see a lot of uses of painted fabric in art quilting or in other kinds of quilting as ornamentation. Really, it can be a very high art thing, but there's also a lot of kind of dye-it-yourself, do-it-yourself versions of fabric printing and painting that technology affords people who wouldn't have been able to do it before. Like the ability to print a photo on fabric and then sew a picture, you know, sew something around it and sew an image into a quilt, or some of the sun dye things that have become popular where you put something down on the ground and dye around it that you see in printmaking, that's come into quilting. So in and of itself, so, you know, fabric painting for fabric painting, I haven't seen as much of that. I have seen some that are painted as part of something else.
Okay, one last question for me, perhaps, is, worldwide, there's a problem with the export of basically the recycling of clothing from the United States into decimating kind of the clothing and textile markets of West Africa mm-hmm. and elsewhere. Has this come up within any of the discussions of the sweatshop movement within craftivism about the idea of somehow sending a message to people not to send their jeans to Africa, in effect?
That has come up, although more of the way it's come up has been, although I'm sure there are people using craft to send that message, more of what I've seen that's engaged it has been on the other end of the don't get rid of the jeans because you no longer like them. Do something with them. Reuse them. Create something, as opposed to saying, oh, well, I no longer want this. Let's drop it in a bag that will eventually be sent to Africa. Mm-hmm. There's the, you know, using it up, reusing it, recreating it ourselves, as opposed to saying, well, you know, it's fashion, it's cheap, I don't want it, let's destroy it. As well as the movement towards some of the more handmade clothing options. Because, you know, if something is bespoke, if something's made for you, if something fits you beautifully, if something's exactly what you want, you're much less likely to say, you know, in a season, ah, I don't want it anymore, put it in a bag and send it over. So there's definitely some of that in another way. And also in using things in different ways, there are some fantastic fiber artists, including a dear friend of mine, who do great things with sweaters. They do entirely different craft projects out of sweaters coming from Salvation Army, out of things that they get from people, as opposed to that, as opposed to sending them elsewhere.
Okay, you're all shy today, you know, because
I'm very nice.
Okay.
I promise.
One more, which is that
he just invites me here so he can ask
one
me
of
questions.
The issues of sweatshops is not only sweatshops, but it's actual health and safety. So mm-hmm. the amount of the Karachi fire and various other things mm-hmm. that are reminiscent of the Triangle Shirtwaist fire here mm-hmm. in the United States. To what degree has, in effect, the death of women on the job in Pakistan or elsewhere ended up in any way within the kind of protest knitting or other things that you've seen?
There have been pieces that have addressed it. There are people who seek to do more valuable clothing here themselves rather than putting the burden on other countries mm-hmm. that have unsafe labor practices. But there have been protest pieces, protest quilts, and the like. I've seen actually some great historical stuff on the Triangle Shirtwaist mm-hmm. Fire, calling it back in various methods. So that awareness is there. More than anything else, I see more, let's stop the problem from happening at this end, as well as let's address this. So kind of a two-pronged action supporting each other, if that makes sense.
Okay, great. Well, let us give Heather another round of applause, please.
Oh,
we have a question.
Good Lord.
Kathy, I've ignored you up till now.
The scarf is,
did they have an effect?
I believe that one did have an effect. I believe that it helped stop what was going on, but I'm not 100% sure. It's definitely prompted more awareness and rallied other people on a lot of cases. You can definitely see people who wouldn't normally be informed about an issue. Like Lisa Ann Auerbach, this fiber artist who does fantastic stuff, and she does these incredibly complex sweaters. And she's done things like a sweater about Abu Ghraib and would wear it. And people who would not necessarily read a newspaper would see that sweater, what's that? And that's an opportunity to start conversation. So it's kind of a case of what we would term slow rhetoric, mm-hmm. that there is a, hey, change this, stop this, see my petition. But there's also a, hey, let me inform you. Let me get you interested about this. So there are effects. Sometimes it's hard to pin them down, but there are definitely cases where things have been effective. Does that answer your question?
Great. Now let's give Heather a round of applause, please. Yes, thank you. Do come a week after Thanksgiving on Thursday to see Tom Pearson talk about metal spinning. And that will be the last of the 2015 calendar year. So we look forward to having you here